Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us for the Kopernik Global Investors Quarterly Update. On today's call, we have David Ivan, Founder, Chief Investment Officer, and Lead Portfolio Manager, to discuss Kopernik's views on the current market environment and the portfolio positioning of its global all-cap strategy. Please note, this call is being recorded and the topics on this call are for informational purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to buy or sell any product or service to which this information may relate. Certain products or services may not be available to all entities or persons. Please consider all risks carefully before investing. All participants will initially be in a listen-only mode. Following Mr. Ivan's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to David Ivan. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, and thanks to everybody. Good afternoon, and appreciate your dialing in. Also, happy to report that on our one-year anniversary, a little over a year ago, we started the business. And we're now over $1 billion in assets under management and growing, so thank you all for your support. And the markets continue to be fascinating. Our reason for wanting to do this in the first place is we like the fact that the market from time to time gets pretty irrational, sometimes more than other times, and we like to take advantage of that. And there's been a lot of emotion in the market lately, and that's exactly what we're looking for as active managers. You got to love the investment business. It's so easy to know what to do, but so hard to do it sometimes. It really requires overcoming emotions and being willing to be unpopular in the short term. I mean, everybody knows buy low, sell high. Yet people do the opposite. Why is that? You know, I was fortunate enough to come into the business when bonds were really cheap, yielding 14%, and nobody wanted to buy them. After bonds went up for 32 years and yield next to nothing now, people feel safe in bonds. Yeah, there are a lot of things, but they're not safe. Why is it they seem safer after going up for 32 years than they did back in 81 after they've been dropping for 16 years? Stocks are pretty interesting, too. They seem so dangerous, Amir, 5-6 years ago when they were dropping by the second in the financial crisis, and now that they've gone up for 5 years and gone up a lot here in the U.S., people are starting to warm up the stocks, starting to like them a lot more. And so, that's an interesting thing to us. Why don't people like to buy low? One, they don't like to go against the trends and do what's unpopular, but also, it's emotions, you know. Warren Buffett will say, be greedy when others are fearful, and fearful when others are greedy. And John Templeton, one of my favorites, it always said, people always ask him, where do things look good? And the wrong question, he says, the right question is, where do things look really challenging? Right now, people are feeling really good about a lot of the world. They're feeling really good about a lot of the markets. They're feeling good about the U.S. stock market and the U.S. bond market and the art market and the collectibles markets and real estate in a lot of areas of the world. And yet there's other places where they're just panicking. Panic's interesting. Yeah, those of you that have been in the business a while, you may remember about 10 years ago, people were panicking over any company that had exposure to asbestos. There were companies that had asbestos back in the 60s that were being put out of business. It was pretty scary, but what a great time to buy Halliburton or Crown Cork or those sort of things. People have been in the bond markets when Drexel fell apart and the United Airlines deal fell apart. It was pandemonium in the high-yield bond market. And to top it off, the SNLs were being forced to sell high-yield bonds. It seemed very scary. It actually turned out to be a very safe and very profitable time for those that were willing to buy it. You know, way back when, after World War II, two of the better things you could have done with your money is by the losers of that war, Germany and Japan. Nobody wanted to touch them. Panic and fear, that's often a great time to buy good companies. Also, about 10 years ago, there was that horrible SARS epidemic in China. I know the whole world was freaked out about that. What a great time to buy Chinese stocks, good stocks. Even here at home, when Obama won the election, amazing how cheap stocks like Eli Lilly and Pfizer and Aetna and things like that became. There was panic. About a dozen years ago, the Bank of England dumped all their gold at $255, and it had been dropping for 20-some-odd years. What a great time to buy that. And then country by country, when Brazil elected Lula as president, people were very upset. Turned out things were okay. Even things extremes, Colombia and Peru, places like that, 10 years ago or less, when there was a lot of violence and the drug game problems. People that bought into those markets but made lots and lots of money. So right now you've got a lot of problems in the Middle East. Nobody's afraid. There's a lot of problems in Russia. People are scared to death. There's a lot of inflation in the art market. People aren't worried. No inflation right now going into gold. People are scared to death of that, even though it is having a pretty good year. But it's interesting how people are really liking some countries, really disliking others, really liking some markets, disliking others. So we're seeing this extremes of emotion right now. And that's what we're looking for as investors. And with that as a backdrop, we're doing what we've always done. We are appraising businesses. We are saying, what do we want to pay for a good business franchise? What do we want to pay for a good business asset? What do we want to pay for companies that meet basic needs? And then the market sometimes says, we agree with you. And other times they will give it away. And just like, as I pointed out in the past, shades of 99-2000, some of the better, more profitable companies on earth are the ones that they're giving away. And some of the exciting but money-losing companies are the ones they're selling at extreme prices. That is our kind of market, and that's why we continue to be excited with what we've seen. And we continue to be able to buy companies that sell not to the U.S. consumer, but still to the emerging market consumer. We have some of the best companies in the world that sell natural gas or electricity from cheap, clean hydroelectricity, or cell phone for services, or sell foods and that sort of thing. We're continuing to like what we see there. Even after a decent run this year, the price of gold mining companies were able to buy gold on Wall Street way cheaper than we can buy gold at the corner gold store. We're continuing to like things like uranium that have fallen from $137 a pound to $28 a pound, despite the fact that the fundamentals, maybe not the short term, but over the medium term, are incredibly good. And so to be able to buy in some of the growing parts of the world and do so at conceivably less risk than the rest of the market, it's very exciting. And for those of you that talk to us, we know that we find risk to be a fascinating but important subject. People that consider volatility to be risk are either not long-term investors or they're missing the point. Those that consider paying too much risky and paying too little to be less risky will be very excited to see that our PEs are a third less than the market, and our price to cash flows less than half of the markets, and our price to book values about a third of the markets, and our price to sales is about two thirds of the markets. And so this is the sort of market we wait for. It's the sort of market we like. And, rather than go over some of the same the themes that you've heard, why don't I keep my comments short and leave most of the time for questions, because usually, especially in this kind of market, there are a lot of questions that are relevant. So why don't we stop for questions?
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, as another reminder, that is star one if you'd like to ask a question. And Gary Magnuson of Morgan Stanley has our first question. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. I just have a minor question. You're a relatively young fund, but I know you've been doing this for a long time, but what about capital gains? Do you have any outlook for the year in this fund? I know a lot of older funds might have 40% embedded gains or 30% and things like that. Anything you can comment there in terms of where your fund stands?
Yeah, in general, it's a backdrop. Maybe it's not a direct answer, but we always run our firm, you know, to maximize returns and are tax aware. So we don't try to minimize taxes. But since most of my money's there, and since we try to run everybody else's money the way we run others, we do pay attention to try to make capital gains long term. If it's getting close, we'll hold off, and we're not, of course, heavy traders anyhow. But we do lots of trims and adds, and the things we are trimming are the things that have been going up. And so, yeah, there should be some capital gains. I've been fortunate enough that the market's been going up. So, there should be some capital gains, but we have not been actively traded. And I don't know if I can or should say more on that. You could, I guess, talk to our, in fact, Catherine or others in the future.
Could you add just where you're seeing opportunities in the world? What the latest scare is for you, or I mean, where you finding things?
Yeah, you know, oddly enough, we're finding things in the very areas that people loved 3 or 4 years ago. We are finding telecom companies in the emerging markets, and we're finding gold companies all around the world. We're finding cheap, clean electricity, whether it's from uranium or hydroelectric power, all over the world. We're finding agriculture. People used to love that at huge, huge discounts to what it would cost here in the States for very good properties. So that's the bulk of it. And in general, the BRICS that people so much loved a few years ago, with the exception of India that's now hitting new all-time highs, the other three of them are many good companies that happen to be in those countries are being given away, so we're finding a lot there. Japan over the last couple of years went from one of our big holdings a year and a half ago to a pretty small half a year ago, but that's actually starting to build up again as some of those companies have sold out. So that's generally where we're finding things.
Thanks.
And our next question comes from Matt Tanner of UBS. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Good afternoon.
Question is, one of our internal analysts at the IB expects a lot of equity raises in the gold miners. And we know what your thesis is on owning them. I was wondering what you expect to see in terms of that and some consolidation.
Yeah, the gold mining is, of course, are interesting. You have this basic collision between incredibly good fundamentals and then a lot of obstacles and challenges. So where we're buying gold for way less than liquidation value and strong, you know, we're getting a lot of free optionality by owning the gold mining companies and the fundamentals, which we're not paying for with our free optionality, are incredibly favorable for gold following its three-year correction in price. So a lot of reasons to want to own gold, but especially discounted gold through gold miners. However, our eyes are wide open. The costs tend to go up. The geopolitical risk is higher, and it probably addresses your last point. Management is something to worry about. These guys have a history of raising capital at the wrong time and spending capital at the wrong time and destroying wealth. And so we do worry about that. And so our approach is is to, one, focus on the companies that own a lot of gold that don't necessarily need to go out and find it or do things. Two, to diversify. The portfolio gold is going to do great, but some of the managements might do something to hurt us. Let's keep it diversified. So we have gold in lots of different countries, lots of different currencies, with lots of different management teams, and so we think we've diversified that. We've bought the companies at a huge discount to what we think they're theoretically worth. So lots of upside. So even if they dilute us a little bit, we still see really large opportunity. And then we have a combination of companies that are running mines now and generating cash flow versus ones that need to come up with cash in the next few years, and then other ones that I'll probably build 4 or 5 years from now that have lots of optionality. So it's basically focus on the best assets, try to get the best management teams, insist on really cheap prices, and insist upon broad diversification. So that's our approach.
Thank you.
And at this time, we have one question remaining in the queue. If you would like to ask a question, ladies and gentlemen, please press star 1. And next, we'll hear from Elizabeth Clegg of TIFF.
Hi, Dave. I have two questions for you. The first being, is Covenant buying companies cheaply or less expensive than the market? And the second is, what do you think the expected return of the portfolio is today?
Okay. Are we buying it cheaply, absolute, or relative? Both. Absolutely. We are absolute investors. We approach return and risk and everything on absolute. So relative is less interesting. But then once we've insisted upon absolute, it's nice to see that our stuff's cheaper than what others are doing. And that's the case, too. As I was pointing out earlier, almost any valuation metric you can come up with, we are really cheap relative to the All Country World Index. But in absolute sense, too, to be able to buy growth companies at 12 times earnings and to be paying a fraction of book value for a bunch of companies that tend to be dominant companies, if not monopolies, and have a sustainable demand profile. Absolute and relative. And the second part of that question was... can you repeat the second?
The return of the portfolio is today.
Oh, yes. What we don't do is come in and say we expect to make 8% this year and 14% next year. What we do is never buy anything that on a risk-adjusted basis we don't think we're going to get a double-digit return on over time. And sometimes that's easier, sometimes that's harder. We view this as actually one of the better times because we are finding so many distressed securities. So, we would hope to get double-digit returns over time from here, and whether that's higher this year and lower next year or lower this year and higher next year, I don't know, but we feel very, very good about owning great quality companies at 60% of book value. So I would certainly hope for double-digit returns, but time will tell.
Thanks.
And next we'll hear from Dan Gallagher of UBS.
Yeah, hey, Dave. Thanks for having this call. Read your piece, comparing Russia with Japan after World War II, and I thought that was kind of interesting. But in thinking that over, and I know generalizations are dangerous, comparing kind of the typical Russian work ethic to the one that Japan demonstrated over the last years, and if you look at capital, which was poured into Japan after World War II, and it appears to be kind of Russia, there's a capital flight issue. And then thirdly, it seemed that Japan was very, I don't know if humble is the right word, but they're very interested in integrating with the rest of the world. And, the regime there seems to be kind of at war, you know, with the West and is moving more and more towards authoritarian ways. I'm just wondering, how inexpensive, things really are. I guess, part of that appearance of inexpensiveness is really tied to the energy sector, which is, I guess, 55% of their index. But could you, talk to me about those kind of key differences and debate that, or is that all how you see that as well in your calculus as you put money to work there?
Yeah, no, very good question. What is Mark Twain saying? And that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. So clearly, this isn't Japan. I, in the letter, put a lot of the similarities. As you point out, there's differences. There's some good, some bad, so we're not saying it's exactly the same, although there has been periods where a lot of capital has come into Russia. It's certainly not this year, but over the last 20 years, there has been good periods of inflow. Japan, there was 3-4 years where capital was coming out of there in the mid-60s. I was pretty young in the 60s, so everything I have is just research I've done. Japan, as far as integrating other cultures and things, they've actually had a reputation for not allowing that, and that's actually one of the things people worry about nowadays, about their population declines, and they're still being reluctant to allow a lot of immigrants. Russia, until a few years ago, had a lot of people leaving the country. Now there's more people coming in, and it's also higher birth rates than there was, but you don't hear a lot about that. I did point out, I think, in there that Japan did have a lot of the same problems that you hear about with Russia. You had the concentration of power in certain hands, and they were hands people didn't like. The banking system was actually more of a problem in Japan. People didn't like the growth of the banking system, and they had a really leverage upon leverage, where Russia doesn't have that. Whereas work ethic, you have to admire the Japanese work ethic. I think that's a good thing. I'm not sure everybody viewed it that way in the 60s, but I don't know. I am old enough to remember that everybody considered their merchandise crappy, that changed over the years to whether it was considered superior. Their strength, of course, was manufacturing, and that has been a great thing over the, most of my lifetime, I guess. Resources 3-4 years ago were looking like the thing that was going to matter in the future. Now people don't worry about it, but if I had to guess, I think over the next 10 years, resources will be a wonderful thing to control. The population is still growing, so I think Russia will end up looking good with resources. But I'm not here to say Japan is good or bad, and I'm sure not here to say that Russia is good or all bad. There are a lot of things to worry about, but both in my own opinion and the quotes of a lot of people I respected over the time, people tend to suggest, and I believe, that when people get really, really, really negative on something, it almost always proves to be overblown. Earlier in the call, named a lot of times in the past where people were panicking on something, and the level of emotions regarding Russia is about as high as I've seen. Of course, another thing I've mentioned to some people I talk with, back in the late 90s, I would talk to people about the Sen stocks that people hated back then, and people would say, yeah, fine, you can buy handguns and alcohol and casinos and you name it, just don't buy tobacco. Really, it was a lot of emotion on tobacco, and now there's a lot of emotion in Russia. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm saying I suspect time will show that it's overdone.
Okay, that's helpful. And then secondly, what's your current cash position, and how defensive will you be or can you be in this fund?
Yeah, cash is, to us, residual to the process. So we're, of course, 100% bottom up. We do pay attention to what's going on in the world, but each stock, we say, how much do we want to own? If the stock goes up a little bit, we trim a little bit. And if the stock falls, we buy a little bit. And there's always stocks we're trimming and always stocks we're adding. And I can tell you, historically, in the global all cap, back in the 2005 through now, it's generally been 0 to 10%. We expect it to stay 0 to 10%. It's 8 to 10, more like 8% right now. And, you know, the U.S., when we used to have the U.S.-only portfolios, that would get into the teens. When we used to be confined to only small and mid, that got into the 20s twice. But with the whole world, all countries, all regions, all industries, all sectors, all market caps, we're finding plenty of things. And so even if we were top-down, we wouldn't see any need to raise a bunch of cash right now. Cash yields zero, and we're finding really great franchises that yield a lot more than zero and are trading below, way below replacement value. So, yeah, cash in the current world is not something that we'll be building.
Thanks.
And next we'll hear from Jeremy Finger of Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead, sir.
Hey, David. Is there an asset level that you're eyeing that you may consider closing the fund, or an asset level that would be unwieldy in some of the opportunities that you see out there today?
Yeah. You know, since a year ago we had no assets and we're a little over $1 billion, it's hard to think about that. But, yeah, we do. We, you know, whether it's $10 billion or $15 billion, but we do not want to be $20 billion, which, of course, is half the level of what we were running 3 years ago, which we, you know, think we did a pretty good job with. Keeping it less than half of that should be no problem. And for the most part, if somewhere between $10 and $15 billion, you would see a soft close, should we ever be so lucky as to get to those levels. We want to be very, very focused. We want to stay small in terms of the amount of assets we're running and then the strategies we're just doing global, of course, and we're staying with just a few channels and strong partners. So being very, very focused is important to us.
Perfect. Thank you.
And next we'll hear from Brian Mackey of Advisor Investments.
Hi, David. Thank you for hosting the call today. I was wondering if you could talk about a little bit about the sort of how you've been following Russia since you've kind of added some positions to the portfolio. You know, does the Malaysian air flight trigger a meeting with your investment team and kind of adjusting the political risk discount that you're giving to those holdings, and just sort of how you've been kind of thinking about the politics getting inside of Vladimir Putin's head in the last few months?
Yeah, what we do is we spend all our time appraising businesses, and that's where we just think we can add value. So we're spending lots of time looking at industry supply and demand, and we're looking at key variables and saying what's the most important factor in this business. Is it asset quality or management or brand name or distribution? And then we value things a lot of ways. We use lots of different metrics, and then we focus on one metric for an asset-rich company, and we look at another metric for asset-light companies, and we'll look at more scenarios on volatile streams, and that's where the value's added. But then we, of course, are not indifferent between buying a really good company in Canada versus buying a really good company in Russia, because we know if we invest in Russia or China or Indonesia or Colombia or Argentina that stuff happens. And so we want to not be the type of person that comes in and pays a high price before bad things happen and then sell them after the bad thing happens and then buy them back 6 months later when nothing bad's happened for a while. So what we do is say we think their stuff will happen. And we don't know what, and we hope we're wrong, but we think it's going to happen. And because of that, if we might buy something at a 10% discount in Canada, let's want a 30% discount in Southern Europe, and let's go for 50% discounts in China and Russia. Let's go for 70% discounts in Argentina. So we do all that. And then we try to stick to it and not like things better after the market's gone up for a while and like it less after horrible things happen. We hate to see horrible things happen, but you know, when a horrible thing like 9/11 happened or when a horrible thing like the financial meltdown happens, those were times to be buying stocks, and we do not like at all the things that are happening in Ukraine, but we think we priced in there asking for half price for some of the best companies on earth, the largest oil and gas reserves and the most dominant banks and things like that, dominant hydroelectric facilities. These are companies you really, really want to own, and so we're not liking them less because of what's happened. We're maybe liking the world less, but we're liking the stocks better when they get cheaper, so that's our approach to it.
So does that trigger any kind of conversation, like in a Malaysian Airlines flight, you know, an incident like that happens, does that trigger a conversation on the investment team at all, or is it just 110% bottom-up, let's not focus on kind of the headline news?
Both. You know, we try to be 100% bottom-up. We also, as a team, meet every day. And one of the great things about this business is having a lot of smart people talk about what's going on and different views on things. And so we certainly do talk about these things. But we don't get into trying to outguess world politics and try to figure out who did this and why they do this and was it an accident or wasn't it doing it and the sanctions going to be effective or not doing effective. We just say, yep, this is all real bad stuff and it's way more than priced into these businesses, so we're gonna own these businesses.
Okay, thanks.
And next we'll hear from Lance Polverini of Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. You know, you answered my question. It was regarding Russia, but so thank you.
Sure, thanks.
And Sean Kilbride of Raymond James has our next question.
Hi, David. Could you briefly elaborate on your case for uranium? You mentioned sort of short, intermediate, and long-term outlooks. Could you just tell us a little bit more about your conviction there, please?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of our favorite areas right now. And the whole willingness to be a patient long-term investor, I think, is one of our competitive advantages. So if you look at the short term for uranium, I guess it's pretty awful. What you've had over the last 2 years was Japanese reactors off stream and talking about the German reactors coming off stream in the future, which I imagine happens, but who knows. And in addition, for 20 years, the Russians have been turning bombs into fuel, and last year was the final deliveries, which I guess were bigger than normal. And so with demand lower than normal and supply above normal, the inventories are really high now, and of course, really high inventories are a bad thing for price. Price fallen from 137 a pound to 28 a pound. That's quite a drop. Now, long-term fundamentals are very, very good, because after 20 years, the Russians have stopped turning bombs into fuel. That's not happening. That stopped more than half a year ago. And without that, supply fails to meet demand. For a dozen years already, we've been using more uranium than we've mined. That's going to have to change now that we don't have this other source of supply. And then the idea that reactors are coming off stream is just wrong. The Japanese will slowly get theirs back on. But outside of that, the Germans might take 20 plants off. The Russians are going to, I mean, they, the Chinese are going to add 20 some odd plants. Yeah, Russia, Saudi Arabia, India, others are building them, and possibly even the U.S. and U.K. are building them. So existing plants are using more uranium than is being mined. 60 more plants are going to come on stream, increasing more demand for uranium. Eventually, supply needs to pick up. That's going to require more mines to get built. Mines are not going to get built at $28 a pound. It's going to be closer to $75 a pound to incentivize people to build mines. So if the price is roughly going to triple, a lot of people like catalysts. We don't spend our time on catalysts. We spend our time on valuations. We like low prices and good fundamentals. We've got low prices and good fundamentals on uranium. Whether it's 2 or 3 or 4 years that it triples in price, we can be patient. But I usually have found out when things are compelling, they happen sooner rather than later. And the prices we're getting on good uranium miners and companies that hold uranium are pretty interesting prices. Just as a year ago, we were able to get interesting prices on the companies that used uranium to generate electricity. And so we very much like both uranium and hydroelectric power. They're the cheapest, cleanest sources of electricity, and to be able to participate at way less than replacement costs. It's very, very interesting. So, yeah, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
And next we'll hear from Gary Magnuson of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead, sir.
Can you just talk about who maybe some of your competitors would be in the business or who you respect in that area? And then as a second question, can you talk about the buildup of your staff, since you've organized like Brodsky, Hernandez, McKinney, Rosenthal, where they all came from? Did they come from trade winds, et cetera? Thank you.
Yeah, certainly. We have 34 people, and that's in addition to having outsourced a lot of the back office and that sort of thing. We've got all kinds of people, lots of experience, lots of different levels of experience and backgrounds, and we think that's good. Every place I've been, I've liked the idea of saying value is prerequisite, bottom up is prerequisite, those aren't negotiable. Outside of that, let's get as many different views as we can. Let's get people with backgrounds from growth and value and bottom up and top down, and 2 years experience and 35 years experience, and let's have lively conversation. And yeah, that's what we've done. So guys like Paul and Lee have lots of experience in this business and write some of the most thought-provoking letters I've ever seen, and having them contribute to the meetings, and they're strong contributors to the meetings, a great thing. And, you know, Mark McKinney and Steve Rosenthal, they worked with me in the early 90s back at Farmers Insurance. Between Farmers and Vinnick and Tradewinds, I think is 19 people have worked for me in the past, and a lot of the rest of the people have worked with me, either the sell side or competitors or people within the business that I've gotten to know over the years. And in a business where people is the most important thing, how great to be in a place to bring in 34 great people. So we feel really great about the team we have.
And then your competitors, any mutual funds that you kind of respect that kind of do what you do?
Yeah, it's a great business. You've got a lot of smart people and get to meet them all. That's what I love about this business. I've always been big fan of the people who aren't in the business, like Jean-Marie Aviard and John Templeton and Bob Rodriguez, I guess, is a little involved. But, yeah, of course, the FBA people and the First Eagle, the IBA people, of course, I respect a lot. Most of the good value people, I both love the fact that we have similar thoughts and similar ways of doing things, and at the same time have almost no overlap in names with a lot of these people. We also think is a wonderful thing. So it's a great business to talk to some of the people I just met and get their views and respect their views and come up with different names. It's a great business.
And Rick Spiedel of Merrill Lynch has our next question.
Thanks. I was going to ask about uranium, so that's been addressed. I'm not sure if your landscape has ever been as broad as it is now, but I noticed last month then you're about 12% U.S. exposure. Has it ever been that low before? And then I would just ask you to comment on the Fed and their, I guess, potential exit.
Market really decides what we own and what we don't, and so we come up with valuations, and the market dictated in, say, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, that we would not own any tech and telecom, and we didn't, and then in 2002 we owned a lot. And in 2006, 7, 8, and 9, we had, of course, no financials when our value index was 45% or something like that. Japan was something that for years and years and years around the 80s, 90s, we didn't own any of. And a year and a half ago, we owned 25% of it, and that quickly fell back under 10% when they took off. And so to your point, yeah, the market really loves the U.S. right now. We love the U.S. too, but when the market agrees with us, that means they're really not giving us anything to buy here. And if you take out resources like Newmont and Peabody, we have very, very little in two or three U.S. names. It's the least we've ever had by far. And like I say, we like the U.S. a lot. We do not believe in the sustainability of profit margins that are double normal in a zero interest rate environment. I will say impossible to sustain. They'll come down eventually, and that should be a headwind. Yet that wasn't happening in a vacuum. That was happening in an environment where emerging markets were being killed, and yeah, so 5 years of U.S. stocks getting more expensive and 3+ years of emerging market stocks getting really, really cheap. We have the most we've ever had in emerging markets. We have the least we've ever had in the U.S. We have the least we've ever had in consumer discretionary, zero, and basically zero in healthcare. This is a really, really bifurcated market. It's as I mentioned before, there are certain countries and certain sectors that they're pricing in really, really good things and other things that are being given away, and our portfolio reflects that.
And the Fed, please?
Oh, yeah. Yep. We don't make predictions. We don't do macro. We're not top-down. We do pay attention to what has happened. Population's gone from 3 billion to 7 billion, growing. Ag hasn't gone up. The money supply, the Fed has, from 1913 to 2008, taken money supply from nothing to $700-800 billion, and then from 2008 until now, they cranked it up 5 times. That has happened. And right now, it's continuing to grow every single day, but at a lower rate than it was now. So we don't make predictions, but we do look at what the market's looking at. If the market right now is saying the creation of $4 trillion worth of money out of thin air cannot possibly cause inflation. Everything I learned in school says it is inflation. I'm not going to worry about whether it is or not. I'm just going to say if I'm going to own a long bond, I want a high, high yield to do that. And the market right now is amongst the lowest yields in history. So we see lots of risk that the Fed may have made a mistake, and we see no reward. We don't need to make a prediction on that. On the other hand, with gold having dropped by a third and the price of the gold mining stocks, we don't have to have much of an opinion on the Fed and to think, gold is sold off so much, whatever the Fed does, it seems pretty cheap to us now. But if, in fact, having created $4 trillion out of thin air is inflationary, we have free call options that are worth quite a bit. Having studied the history of money a lot of times, it seems to me that exit is impossible, never has happened, and probably won't ever happen. If they thought things were pretty bad, and they really weren't that bad the last couple of years, things have been fine, why they've wanted to print that much money into a growing economy with rising markets that had been rising for 3 years ago, why they felt like they needed to print that much money, I don't know. But the idea that they'll take money out of the system in an environment that could get weaker, that would be shocking. So my personal guess is they'll keep printing less and less and less until sometime the economy weakens or unemployment goes up or the stock market falls or housing market falls, and then they'll be back to printing. I don't know if that's right or not, but I know whether that's right or wrong, people should really, I think, feel some need to have some of their money in farmland and utilities and phone franchises and gold mines, and they should think twice about having all their wealth in bonds or dollars, because the Fed, by their own admission, is in unventured territory.
Thank you.
And Ted Tu of Integris has our next question.
David, hi. Thanks for the call. Just a couple quick questions. One is, do you hedge FX or is everything total return? And the second part of the question is whether in this environment you're devoting any time or increasing time to short ideas. Thanks.
Yes, we do not hedge FX. We may or may not be any good at it, but more importantly, the ones that most need to be hedged can't be hedged. And also, we have a diversified portfolio. We have resource companies that will do well if the currency falls. We have exporters that will do well if the currency falls. We have importers that will be hurt if the currency falls. And we have domestic ones that will likely be hurt if the currency falls. We have multinationals that produce and sell everywhere. We don't know which way we want the currency to go. And so we believe if we buy good companies and we buy them at big discounts and they're all wealth creators and it's diversified across lots of currencies, that'll play out well in the long run, and currencies will help us a little 1 year and hurt us a little the next. And the second part of that question was
whether you're devoting any resources to short ideas in today's world.
What we've always done is view ourselves as appraisers of businesses, and so we spend all our time saying what are we buying and should we value it on assets and cash flow in different ways, and it is worth $30, and in our opinion that's our best guess. And if the market says you can have it for 15, we're going to buy that thing. And if the market says, nah, we think 150 is the right price, then we are going to short that. And that is really no incremental work in our burn. You know, for the last 8 or 9 years, we've been running funds that have the ability to short, and it really is no more work. We are appraising businesses, and we are looking for the market to have a way different opinion than we do, either a way lower valuation or a way higher. And now it's one of those markets we like. It's not a matter of whether the market's cheap or whether it's expensive. It's both. But our healthcare analyst is finding shorts, and our technology analyst is finding shorts, and our consumer discretionary is finding shorts. And, you know, our resource analysts are finding longs, and our utility analysts are finding longs, and our agriculture analyst is finding longs. And so each analyst is appraising things and alerting us when the market, in our opinion, has it way wrong one way or another.
Right. So just a quick follow-up. In that case, in portfolios or products where you can short, what type of net exposure are you running? And does that move around much, or is it fairly static? Thanks.
If we stay between 20 and 80 net, to be above 80, it's become a long only, really, to be below 20 net in an environment where every central bank owner is printing money like crazy, something we really don't want to do either. We're in the high 30s right now. As far as how it can move along, in early 2008, we were close to 20% net, and in early 2009, we were close to 80% net. The market dictated it as it fell. We covered shorts and went long more, and so that we don't sit there and say we have X opinion of the market, bottom up. We're buying what we like and shorting what we don't, and the tougher it gets to find longs and the easier it gets to find shorts, the more the net drops.
Thank you.
And Jason Jones of Morgan Stanley has our next question.
Hi, Dave. What's your target on CCJ? I noticed that it was in the SMA. Trade wins around $44 around Fukushima. And my second question is if you're just finding any value or opportunities in Europe today.
On CCJ, I don't have the model right in front of me, but I think somewhere in the 56 area. Don't hold me to that. But leveraging the incremental price of uranium at some point being in the mid-70s in the next 2, 3, 4 years. And then, of course, we risk adjust things, so we want a big discount to that. So over the years, back in, I think, 99 or 2000s when we first bought it and had a lot of it, and the stock went up 17 times, and we were, by that time, completely out of it. And then when it fell back in the 40s, we might have nibbled, but it wasn't until the 20s that it became really interesting. And when it got down to, 13 or 14, it became a real big position. And then, once again, the second part of that question. Yeah, there was CCJ. And then the second part of that question again, sorry.
Oh, just in regards to any opportunity in European stocks at this time.
Oh, yes. Definitely. If you look at Europe, it's, of course, lots of different countries and different regions. So we've certainly found opportunities there, although we were finding a lot more opportunities a year or two ago when people were very upset about the euro and worried it was going away, and when they especially were worried about Southern Europe. I think a lot of our concentration in the past has been places like Italy and France and, a name or two in Greece and that sort of thing. But we've actually trimmed Europe a good bit over the last 6 months and moved more into emerging markets.
And there are no further questions at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you all again. A lot of good questions and certainly exciting times to be in the markets. And yeah, thanks again for everybody's support. Have a good evening.
And that does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation.